So what we ended on last time was amphibian courtship and talking about the Sicilians and the salamanders. And remember, the salamanders are primarily focusing a lot on using olfactory and visual cues to basically encounter individuals as well as in the process of courtship. And there are a few families of salamanders that have external fertilization, but most have internal fertilization. Okay, so the Asian salamanders, the hellbenders, and the sirens are external fertilization, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and then all the others have internal fertilization. And the ones that have internal fertilization have generally elaborate courtship rituals that they go through. The external fertilization, to our knowledge, there isn't much courtship that goes on. They function more like fish, and anyways, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Although some of this is a lack of knowledge. We'll talk about that with respect to the ones that do external fertilization, whether or not they have a whole lot of courtship. Okay, so we went through these five steps last time with respect to just general steps. When you look across all the caudates that do have some type of courtship and internal fertilization, what do? And usually the male detects the female, the male nudges the female with the snout, and then blocks the female, and then they kind of nudge and they move together and maybe do some different types of courtship movements and things like that. Then ultimately the male moves away from the female, and hopefully that female then follows the male, okay? And if she follows, that's a good thing. And so he continues. If not, he may try to still coerce her, or after a while, he just may give up and try to find another female. The male then deposits a spermatophore, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And then the female picks it up with her cloacal lips, and we'll talk about the internal fertilization process in a little bit. But that's the general steps, and there's a tremendous amount of richness and variability with respect to salamander courtship, but those are kind of the things that go on just in general. So we talked about that last time, and we'll go through one example a little more detailed of salamander courtship for the mole salamanders, Abistomatidae, and kind of give you an example of the typical ambistomid salamander. Okay, and then we talked about energetic cost and broke it down into those salamanders that actually do courtship on land and those that do it in the water. And usually terrestrial courtship just lasts about an hour. And it is not very energetically costly. That's an important thing to remember. It is not believed that terrestrial courtship of salamanders is energetically limiting to the species. Okay, and that also ties into the thought, one of the hypotheses of why the plethodontids don't have lungs, because they primarily do terrestrial courtship. The females may then deposit the eggs, the fertilized eggs, on land or in the water, but the courtship, the vast majority of plethodontids is terrestrial. And anyways, it's thought that, of course, it being less energetically demanding, it's less oxygen demanding, those things are directly correlated. But anyways, the orange line here represents resting levels. This is actually the amount of oxygen consumed, and we can think about that as directly correlated with the amount of energy burned or metabolized. And the center one here is for courtship. So you can see it's not that much more for courtship that is actually consumed as far as oxygen levels. In fact, it's only 38% more than resting. And on average, a male, I believe that's male statistic, but a male will expend around 2.7 joules of energy, which is equivalent to usually about 1% of the energy intake in a day. They spend actually more energy just searching for food items, okay? So in searching for food items above resting levels, it's about 75% greater energy that they're consuming than, so you can see that's nearly double of what courtship is, okay? Now aquatic, however, there are fewer statistics on. However, it is believed that those salamanders that breed in an aquatic environment, that the courtship activity is energy limiting, okay? It is energy limiting. And it is often the courtship rituals are often much longer than terrestrial, usually 2 hours or even more. And the other thing that there are often several courtship sequences. We'll go through a courtship sequence here in a second. And instead of just one, which is often occurs on terrestrial courtship, there's often several. And the other thing that affects the courtship activity is the dissolved oxygen levels. Since most of these salamanders, obviously they can respire through cutaneous respiration, but the activity that is involved in aquatic courtship cannot totally depend on cutaneous respiration. They need to breathe. So they literally are holding their breath. And if you have dissolved oxygen levels in a wetland, it can affect whether or not courtship sequences are actually completed. And so these are, you know, sublethal things that really can happen when you think about it with respect to a population with dissolved oxygen levels being low. Okay, so it's just something that we're going to be moving into and have lots of guest lecturers coming in, and I'll be talking about a lot of the conservation stuff. And so just to kind of start to bridge those thoughts. And again, as I mentioned, energy limiting for aquatic. Okay, so that's pretty much where we ended last time. And here is an example of amphibian courtship for the ambystomids. For the mole salamanders, most of the species, in fact, all of the species are breeding between January and March, for the most part. That is the concentration of their breeding, okay? And the males actually go down to the breeding areas, the breeding ponds, before the females. And the exception of that early breeding season for the mole salamanders are in areas that are relatively dry. And those species tend to cycle their breeding season, like the anurans, around rain events. But for the most part, the ambystomids are breeding during, you know, right now, January to March. In fact, with the warmer temperatures and the rain that we had today, there are certainly some mole salamanders that are emerging. Okay, so this is the kind of a general schematic, which is in Dulman's book, for the ambystomid salamanders. And this is kind of how it goes. The dark silhouette here is the male, and the light one is the female. And so you have the male here that comes up, encounters a female, approaches that female, and then nudges her with his snout. And that nudging may go on for a while, and or it could be very quick as 10 seconds, okay? But then the next step is the nudging then goes into the male either nudging right back at the base of the tail and the female doing the same. And in some species, they even grab on to each other, okay? Bite each other and hold on to each other. And they go into a circular waltz. Now, this is all in the water, okay? So they go into a circular waltz. And that can take a little while, usually not more than a minute or so, but sometimes longer. So when the male thinks that, you know, he's kind of, you know, shown his stuff, then he moves on. and he hopes that the female follows, okay? And hopefully the female follows. As the female is following, he is moving his tail back and forth, and he's also swaying his hips, okay? So swaying his hips back and forth and his tail back and forth. And that, she may follow him for a while, for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, could be even longer. And so that's process is kind of called the tail fan, and then you have the lateral shuffle, which is moving the hips, and that's really done together. And that can be really as quick as 10 minutes, or it may go longer. At some point, the female, hopefully, says, okay, this seems to be a fit male, and I'm ready to reproduce. She will nudge the male in his cloacal region, which is a signal to the male to say, okay, go ahead and deposit your spermatophore. And so he does. He deposits the spermatophore. The female moves over. It picks it up with her cloacal lips, then follows the male. The male then, if the spermatophore is picked up, then he bolts. He's done, okay? And he goes to try to find another female. And then the female, for most embistomatids, they are ovulating at that time, and they then go and nearly immediately or within a few days go and deposit the fertilized eggs. Okay, and we'll talk about internal fertilization in a little more detail in a couple slides. She may not pick up that spermatophore, okay, for whatever reasons that she is chemically detecting. Maybe there is something that there's not enough sperm in there that she feels or whatever. So at that point, she may continue to follow the male or not. And if she doesn't, then the male tries to corral her again. So they may go through this several times. He may deposit some more spermatophores. Or he may just end up abandoning the female and going looking for another mate, and she may do the same. Okay, so this can go on, and again, at the same time, this is underwater, and it's relatively energetically demanding.
How many spermatophores can they deposit?
That's a good question, but it's certainly limiting. Yeah.
What's the structure of the spermatophore? What's it made of? Just proteins?
Proteins, exactly. Yeah, and there's a sperm cap to it. And well, I have some pictures of it later, and we'll kind of talk a little bit about the size and the structure of it. But basically, proteins, sperm and proteins, but I can actually find out the details for you if you'd like, but it's about as detailed as I can be right now. Okay, so the female then, for embistomids, will deposit her eggs underwater attached to some type of structure. It's often vegetation, but it can be any type of vertical structure in the water. I've seen them attach egg masses to anchor lines where you've had just off your dock. But the whole point in doing that is so that that egg mass doesn't fall down into the mud and get covered with sediment and reduce oxygen levels, and which could ultimately hinder or negatively impact the development of the embryos. So, you know, after a little while, you have these guys swimming around. In fact, for them to get that big, it takes several months. That larvae is probably a good 5 months old, okay? And this is a tiger salamander larvae. And as we talked about before, well, I mean, I don't know if we have talked about this, but we'll talk about when we talk about tadpole biology, and I think Dr. Echternaut may have mentioned it. But caudate larvae are all predators, okay? And tadpoles are omnivores. They're not strictly herbivorous, and I'll give you a paper on that. And so they do eat some meat or insects or whatever. Some animal life. There you go. All right. And for most of the ambystomatids, they do have the capability of pedomorphism. Tiger salamanders are a very good example. So if you have very good, stable water conditions with decent water quality, they will go through a partial metamorphosis where their lungs develop some, their limbs develop fully, their jaws develop a little bit more, their mandibles, and then the reproductive structures develop. And so you can have reproductively viable adults that have external gills. And I passed last time around some tiger salamander pedomorphs. And they're facultative, so if the water does drop or the conditions get poor, those pedomorphs can go through metamorphosis and become a terrestrial adult. So, any questions with that? All right. In anurans, courtship is generally not elaborate compared to the caudates. Now, their primary courtship, which takes a lot of energy, which we talked about last time, is their advertisement call. But that's basically it. The male's calling to the females. There's very little interaction when it comes to breeding. So usually the male is sitting in an area or calling, or again, we'll talk about satellite males again, which we've talked about before. And the female comes up like this one and nudges the male. And that is a cue at that point that she has chosen that male to mate with. And at that time, he moves around and she moves forward and gets into the position for amplexus. There are some pre-amplectic rituals that exist with some of the tropical species, where, like this is, for example, Eurythrodactylus jasperi, which is believed to be extinct in Puerto Rico. And this little guy jumps around the female or used to when the species existed, and does some courtship rituals. I mean, he's calling as well, but there's also some, and you do see that with some other species. But in general, very little courtship rituals go on. It's just the calling, and then female says okay. Now, one thing, particularly when you get into very high species-rich areas or you have explosive breeders coming all out from hibernating or estivating, and they come out and they're coming all down at the same time, is you get a lot of species that may be similar, like toads or even some of the narrow mouths or spadefoots, and the males can get confused with the females and vice versa. And so some species, at least it's been documented that they'll use tactile cues, and those tactile cues are in two categories. One is the size of the female, and the other is skin texture. And those are the two cues that have been, at least there's some evidence to support that some species that are closely related will use. Okay, two examples are the American toad and the Woodhouse's toad, which occurs farther west into the Great Plains states and into Texas. This toad species, the Woodhouse's toad, is probably our largest toad species in the United States, in North America. If not the largest, it's pretty close to it. So it is quite a bit bigger than the American toad. And so the males of American toads will show preference and can appear to tell the difference between the Woodhouse's toad, which is much larger, the females of the Woodhouse's toad, and they preferentially select the smaller individuals of their species. There may be some olfactory stuff that goes on as well. It's also been demonstrated for the eastern narrow-mouthed toad and the Great Plains narrow-mouthed toads, where they overlap in Texas, where the former is, the females are larger for the eastern narrow-mouthed toad. And again, same type of recognition by the males. When you think about it, there's got to be something going on, because males would seem to prefer larger females, because that is an indication of fecundity and potential reproductive capability, producing more eggs. Larger females within a species produce more eggs. So there has to be something here. Obviously, hybridizing is not a good thing. So they're queuing in on size. And again, there may be some olfactory things there where they're picking up different types of pheromones that help them recognize. And then the other thing that has been suggested is skin texture. Where they overlap, and specifically comparing those two species. Within their species, they certainly, the males would prefer females with a larger body size.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, on the eastern, there's can be confusion with Fowler's toad. But there's less, because their calls are more different than the Woodhouse's and the American toad. Okay. Any other questions? All right. So we often see this a problem, you know, with, well, not a problem, but an occurrence with, and confusion with species, with explosive breeders. And it is pretty chaotic. If you've ever been, again, west of the Mississippi in a dry area and you've seen species that are explosive breeders coming down and breeding, I mean, it is pandemonium. It's impossible to drive down the road without running over them. And they are crazy. They really are. And this is a picture of a Great Plains toad. This is very common. Amplexing a piece of dirt, and you often see things like this. Again, this guy's been underground for probably 6-8 months. You know, feels kind of warm to him, right? You know, and you know what? It's not giving a release call, so it must not be a male. So, all right, I'm going to hang on to this thing. I'm not letting it go. So you'll see that. And you'll see that type of confusion. So it's not surprising that they get confused even with other species.
Is this one that's also supposed to be able to recognize females of other species? Because that seems a little odd. If they're confusing rocks with females of the same species, that they would be able to differentiate females of their own species and somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is Bufo cognatus. So it's not the one that was done in this study up here. Yeah, but, and I don't know. I'd have to go back to literature and look at that. Most of the work that's been done was done by Krupa out of University of Kansas. And he did quite a bit of work back in the 80s with Great Plains still, as far as life history. So the other strategy, of course, in this whole process that we've talked about, is instead of calling and spending a lot of energy calling, why not just be a satellite male and intercept females? And so that is we'll talk about the differences in energy allocations between calling and satellite males in a second. But you do see this. This is this is. These are actually two male Woodhouse's toads, and here's a satellite male coming up even after another male is amplexed, and it's actually amplexed to a female Great Plains toad. And this toad is dead. They actually drowned her with this male here on top. And so you do see this happening, and So you see male-male interactions, you know, wrestling and things like that. You see quote-unquote rapes, if you want to call it that, with the satellite males. You see crazy stuff like this that happens where they're amplexing and he's amplexing from the wrong side and there's already a male on her and they drown the female. So it is pretty nuts. You generally see this with your explosive breeders. The more continuous, prolonged breeders that are establishing territories and calling a lot. The calling here is just advertisement. Here I am. There are no territories set up with explosive breeders. They're coming down, they're breeding within like 2 weeks. Okay? Now, it doesn't mean that if a male comes over, there won't be some type of grappling that goes on, but those territories are not established like you see with your prolonged. That's a good question, but I would probably say her head probably have to be underwater for, you know, maybe 5 minutes. Yeah.
What was the satellite male looking to accomplish? I mean, like, did he not see the other male?
I don't know. Didn't get interviewed, I guess. Yeah, it doesn't make sense from an evolutionary standpoint, but it really, there's a lot of confusion that goes on with these explosive breeders. And, you know, this could be a younger male, too, that's just less experienced. I don't know. But he may think he's doing all the right thing, or maybe he's hoping that this male gets discouraged and lets go and he can flip around or whatever. Any other questions? Okay, so types of amplexus. All right, amplexus is the process of males ultimately holding on to the females in a certain way so they can deposit their sperm over top of the eggs. And it is also thought that with some of the amplexus types that they help stimulate ovulation, okay, and the release of the eggs. So the first one is inguinal, and those are spadefoot toads there. Eastern spadefoot, actually. And inguinal is considered the most primitive of the amplexus types. Okay? And primarily because here, these are New Mexico spadefoots, Spia multiplicata, and primarily because the vents are not directly next to each other. All right? However, what you do see is when the female begins to release her eggs, she will arch her back ventrally, and the male will arch his back dorsally so that they bring their cloaca close to each other. Both of these are inguinal, yeah. You can't really see his arms, but they're around her waist. That's the bottom line. Yeah, that one?
Yeah.
There we go. Yep, that is inguinal. The second type, syphilactic, is most common in tropical species. And as you can see here, it is over the arms. Okay, the male grasps over the arms of the female. Okay, on the side of the head. Most common with your tropical species, dendrobatids, etc. And it's not just, that's not like, not all dendrobatids are not syphilactic. They do have other types of amplexus, which we'll actually talk about one particular example. So there's syphilactic up there. I think a syphilic. I think I was putting a T in there. Syphilic. Okay? So the third type is what is very common with our toads as well as many of our tree frogs, and that's axillary. That is grasping the female under the armpits. Okay? Grasping the female under the armpits. And some of them will reach all the way around like you see here. but underneath of the armpits. And of course we see that a lot with our tree frogs, our bufos, our ranids, and that is kind of an example. In some of the tropical species, they'll just have their thumbs underneath of the armpits, and they'll actually have their other fingers wrapped around the arms themselves with one of the fingers up by the tympanum. So there are some variations to it, but generally it's underneath of the armpits. Okay, some other ones that you hear but are not very common are glued breviceps, which is a microhyoid, which we talked about before. That's the one where the male is very rotund and basically excretes, produces a secretion that glues him to the back of the female because he cannot reach around. Now, this picture here is a little bit abnormal because it's the male that is bigger than the female and cannot reach around completely. It makes this female look really, really disproportionate. But he's so rotund, he can't reach around. The next one is straddle, and here's an example right here where the male, is getting a piggyback ride. Hind legs are right on the side of the female's head. Really not a good idea from an evolutionary perspective. As she releases his eggs or her eggs, he releases sperm that runs down her back. Obviously, you want to have your vents as close as possible when you're attempting external fertilization. And the last is independent here, which actually also has been considered a type of internal fertilization. The vents, the cloaca of both the male and the female are put directly opposite of each other, and the male actually releases the sperm and it technically internally fertilizes the female. And that's a particular species of dendrobatid that does that. And we'll talk a little bit about that in internal fertilization, when we get to internal fertilization, next slide or so. Okay. And plexus, on average, occurs for about 1 to 2 hours. However, certain species will amplex for much longer than that. 12 hours will amplex through the night. And even be amplexed to the next morning, like a lot of the toad species will do that, will amplex for a very long time. Of course, they're releasing a lot of eggs too. All right, so external internal fertilization. The external fertilization for the salamanders, again, we have three species of salamanders. Here's a hellbender right there. Again, very similar to fish. The female deposits the egg, male moves over the eggs and deposits sperm, just like fish do. Again, not a whole lot of courtship is documented, although when we were over in St. Louis, they have a captive hellbender population, and one of the guys that works with them has observed some courtship behavior where the males are often of a rock and have... he's observed them pulling females toward them, okay? And they often lay their eggs underneath rocks, and then the males will defend those eggs. And for these groups of families, they're either the eggs are laid as paired sacs or they're laid in strings. All right. Again, most of the external fertilization that we see in amphibians is with the anurans. And, of course, they can lay their eggs in the water, they can lay their eggs on land, and often on land we talk about in trees. For those that deposit their eggs in the water, they generally have larger clutches than the ones that are depositing eggs on land or in the trees, okay? Clutch size of anurans that deposit their eggs in the water are usually greater than 100 and can be all the way up to 10,000, 12,000 for some of the toad species. Generally, it's less than 50 eggs and often down to 10, 20 eggs for ones that lay their eggs in trees, okay, which are primarily your tropical species. Okay, the process of external fertilization for those species that deposit their eggs in the water is that abdominal contractions begin, and often that's thought that amplexus helps with those abdominal contractions. The eggs begin to move down the cloaca. That signals the male those abdominal contractions. The male then, again, arches his back dorsally to bring his vent closer to the female, who arches her back ventrally, bringing those vents closer together, but they may not be in direct contact, depending on the particular type of amplexus. And then the male releases his sperm over the eggs as those are released. He then may organize those eggs, it just depends on the species, with his feet as they're coming out, and he's fertilizing and organize them into some type of structure that's, well, just more organized, even into a ball. And for BUFOs, one characteristic of BUFOs is that as she is laying eggs and he is depositing sperm, they're doing this in shallow water, and she is moving forward and walking through vegetation. And we even talked about the difference in our two BUFO species. Usually fowler's toad will walk a shorter distance, and the eggs will be more in a more constricted area than American toads, which seem to walk farther over a farther distance, over up to 10 meters or more. Okay, for terrestrial or arboreal, if it's in the trees, egg deposition. Usually, eggs are deposited on a leaf, okay? Of course, they could be deposited in a bromeliad with water, and those all relate back to different types of developmental strategies. But for the most part, when they're in the trees, they're depositing them on a leaf. Again, same thing where you have abdominal contractions, signal the male to release his sperm, and they do the same thing. Usually, though, for those species that are releasing their eggs in a terrestrial environment, their vents are in direct contact with each other, okay? And as those eggs are released, they move forward. The male and the female move forward, much like the BUFOs, except you're on a leaf, okay? So you're in a smaller surface area, and they deposit those eggs in a line usually, okay? Okay, so then the eggs are often kept wet and often defended by the male or the female or perhaps both of them. Generally, when it comes to defending for anurans in a terrestrial environment, defending the eggs, it's usually the male for anurans. For salamanders, it's usually the female, okay? So that's a difference between the two orders. And of course, there are a variety of developmental processes that can occur from here, including, you know, direct development, etc., and or the eggs do hatch and then ultimately fall into the water, maybe like a glass frog over a stream or something like that. And a lot of the poison arrow frogs have that type of developmental strategy as well. That's it for external fertilization. For internal fertilization, the Sicilians. Okay, for what we know, most of the Sicilians do have internal fertilization, and it occurs through a sexual organ called the phallodium, which is basically made of connective tissue from the cloaca, and it is used to deliver sperm. The phallodium is inserted into the cloaca of the female. And again, remember that the male and the female generally have kind of a convex disc that or a convex area around the cloaca that helps, it's believed, helps suction them together and hold them together. The phallodium is inserted, and the sperm travels down the longitudinal gradients, the longitudinal grooves of the phallodium, and then is deposited into the cloaca of the female. Okay, and copulation, or at least when they're together, usually lasts for a couple hours for the species that have been studied. For the anurans, the internal fertilization is occurs in the tailed frogs. Again, tailed frogs inhabit fast-flowing streams. Hence, it's not a good idea to just let your sperm go out and do external fertilization. You'd have a very low fertilization rate. So the tailed frogs have this tail, which is a cloacal extension, which again is inserted into the cloaca of the female to hold them close together. And he releases the sperm. It travels down that, follows its tail down into the cloaca of the female. Okay? So think of it, the cloaca being here, the tail is inserted, and then it releases its sperm and it travels into the cloaca of the female. There is no any type of tube or anything like that that is actually transmitting the sperm. It's just following still externally down the tail, just like the Sicilians. Usually the male is in a sitting position like you see here with the female and with inguinal and plexus. And copulation can be as long with the tailed frogs as a day long. Okay. Another type of internal fertilization is cloacal apposition, which is again what we were talking about before, this independent amplexus, where they put their cloaca opposite of each other with some species of Denrobatids, and the male releases his sperm into the cloaca of the female. Okay, so that's been shown with Jasperi and Coqui, Elytherodactylus Coqui. Again, salamanders are, most of them have internal fertilization, as we've already talked about. And the males release a spermatophore. Again, here's a picture of a spermatophore. And it has a sperm cap. The female may pick up the entire spermatophore or just that sperm cap. At any rate, the sperm that is in the sperm cap then is stored within the spermatheca of the female. And it can be stored there, depending on the species, for up to a couple years. For some species, they are ovulating right then. They are then basically go to a place where they're going to release the eggs. As the eggs are released, then the sperm leave are forced out of the spermatheca, and those eggs are fertilized as they are released from the female. For those that are viviparous species, or ovoviparous species, the sperm actually at some point, there is some signaling to the sperm to actually that ovulation is occurring, and the sperm then travel down into the cloaca, up into the oviduct, and actually fertilize directly in the oviduct for those species that have that type of developmental cycle or that developmental strategy. Okay, so ovulation stimulates the sperm one way or another, whether it is to be just directly deposited into the cloaca for ultimately release of the eggs and then external development, or internal, okay, where they travel up the oviducts. Now, with respect to deposition of external deposition of eggs, we talked about just a little bit. In a lentic environment, okay, they're often deposited in attached to twigs and leaves. So lentic environments are still water environments, okay, pond-like environments. They're deposited on twigs and leaves, again, because to keep them up in the water column where they can be in areas that are not extremely low in dissolved oxygen. One interesting thing that the newts do is that they will actually wrap the eggs in a leaf. They'll use their hind legs and they'll wrap after the eggs are deposited on a leaf in the water. They will wrap them up, and it's believed that that is to reduce depredation on the eggs. Not only will other species eat those eggs, but newts themselves will be cannibalistic on other newts' eggs and even developing larvae. In a lotic flowing system, eggs are usually put underneath of a stone, usually in either single eggs or in a row or a cluster, or they're put up underneath of stream banks. Again, out of the direct flow of water, as well as hopefully out of the direct the direct contact of potential predators. Okay? At least to try to reduce the detection probability of predators. For in terrestrial salamanders, female salamanders will lay their eggs under stones, in twigs, leaves, under leaves, in logs themselves, and again, they will usually defend those eggs. Yes, sir.
Can the female hold more than one sperm packet or sperm piece?
Yes, she can. And the interesting thing is, actually, somebody had a question about whether or not she can, because some species have the capability of potentially determining the relative fitness of sperm, and can reject certain sperm versus other sperm. And now I don't know what the extent of that capability is with salamanders. Okay, so the last slide here is the cost of reproduction. And the Tungera frog, which is located throughout Mexico and down into Central America, is one of the species where actually the males and the females, with respect to the cost of reproduction, they have been compared. And to look at the relative energetic cost that a male puts into reproduction versus females. So let's think, first of all, what type of male activities cost energy? The call. That's the number one thing. We've already talked about it, right? The call requires energy, and it is very energetically demanding. What are other things the male puts in as far as energy? Yeah, potentially defending a territory. Exactly. And
sperm,
exactly. So those are some things there. Sperm, calling, territorial defense, amplexus. There is some energy involved in holding on to the female. For females, obviously the eggs, right? What else? Locating the males, yeah, because generally the males are stationary, the females are moving around trying to find them. And there are risks involved in that aren't even energetic risks, but are certainly related to an increased probability of predation. So locating a suitable male, those are the primary investments of the female. Okay, so, well, we've got four things for males, two things for females. How do they stand up with respect to energy investment? For this particular species, as a model, the calling males, on average, use or expend around 3.25 kilojoules of energy. Okay? 3.25 kilojoules of energy. Remember, 4.25 joules equals one calorie. So you can do the math if you want to think about calories. Now, what about satellite males? We talked about that before. One-third of the energy is expended by satellite males. So again, there is an energetic advantage to being a satellite male. And as we talked about before, you may be a satellite male at different times of the year, depending on your energy stores. And other times of the year, you may be a calling male. And in general, the smaller males or the younger males often are satellite males. Okay? And if you just happen to be genetically smaller, you may always be a satellite male. Okay? That makes sense. You also don't store as much energy as a larger male can. You don't have that capability. So, somewhere between 1 and 3 or 4 kilojoules of energy. Females, for this species, around 41 kilojoules of energy. Most of that going into egg production. So, certainly females are investing, you know, somewhere around 20 times more energy approximately equal to 10,000 calories. For ectotherms, that is a hell of a lot of energy, okay? So they're expending a lot of energy to go into those eggs. And most species, the females are only producing one clutch per year. Multiple clutches do exist with certain species, and it depends on certain conditions. This amount of energy for Cokies has been estimated before, which is similar to the Tungera frog. Around 40 to 45 kilojoules of energy. The female investment, again, is around 20 times greater than males. So some species do produce multiple clutches, but it is relatively rare. It tends to be explosive breeders. And the way explosive breeders, again, breed is they come out, they're very quick, within 2 weeks, and even it can be within days, the female deposits her eggs. If it's early enough in the year, maybe in May, she may continue to then build resources up, catabolize, build eggs, and ultimately produce a second clutch if conditions are favorable again later on in the year, maybe into June or July, and they get another rain event or there's a calling male. But in general, multiple clutches are rare in an urn species. Okay? And it is directly related to the amount of energy that goes into producing those eggs and the opportunities. And for those that actually have parental care, it certainly is either not even possible or it's just done very, very infrequently, just with respect to... And again, where you see that parental care is generally in the tropics. Of course, you still have rainy and dry seasons down there, so those usually are when the breeding cycles are rotating around, which corresponds to our seasonal cycles that we have here with temperature. Okay, so the predation risk is generally considered greatest for males, for calling males, less for certainly satellite males, and it's believed less for females. Even though they're moving around, when you open your mouth, your vocal sac, when you identify yourself to the world that you're there, predators are listening, as we talked about before. So, you know, yeah, there is risk involved in calling males that really, you know, can't be equated from an energetic standpoint. So, At any rate, males are less energy, and often you see males reproducing multiple times, even up to somewhere, you know, around 8 times a breeding season. And as we talked about before, how long can a male generally last? I mean, across species calling. If a male in good physical condition starts calling, how many nights can they go consecutively? Less than a week? It's usually less than 2 weeks, about 15 days or so, before they really have depleted all of their lipid reserves. So for any given breeding season, whether it's in the tropics or whether it's in temperate areas, males have to take breaks if they have not reproduced, or if they have reproduced, and build those reserves back up. Again, generally feeding is limited when it comes to the breeding season for males. I just plugged this in because we're done with courtship and breeding, and I hadn't mentioned anything about what about the age of first reproduction with respect to anurans and caudates. You know, when do they first start breeding? Okay, and there's tremendous variability. And actually, in your required reading, you'll see the amount of variability that exists. There's a couple tables there. You may have already read it. I don't know. But generally for anurans, they can breed. For most of the species, they can breed after their first year. They're ready to go from that point in which they are a metamorph. 1 year later, they can breed. Okay, so usually a year for most anurans. For most caudates, it's usually 2 years. Now, there are certainly species of anurans that it takes longer than that. Our toads are an example. They often do not breed until at least 2 years. American bullfrogs, their tadpoles generally develop 2 years before they even go through metamorphosis. So you're talking 3 years or so before they breed. But as an average across anurans, it's usually a year, and it's over 2 years for most of the salamanders. Okay, now I know I kept you all long, but I wanted to finish this up and not have a lecture broken between exams, and also try to tap back into these thoughts after an exam, so in 2 weeks. All right, thanks y'all, and we will see you guys on Thursday.